The Bible talks about that God gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their descendants the land of Israel. Actually, they're only on a small percentage of that today. It goes from the Euphrates all the way to the Wabi River in Egypt. And Israel's only on approximately 25% of that today. But the land of Israel was a gift by God. It's promised land. And it's not to be divided, or the city of Jerusalem is not to be divided. And what I've found out through watching this closely for over 12 years is when we put pressure on Israel to divide their land, we have a major record-setting catastrophic event happen the same day or within 24 hours. And I also noticed the greater the pressure we apply on Israel, the greater the corresponding event, such as 9/11, such as Hurricane Katrina, such as the Joplin tornado outbreak recently. You know, we've always had these storms, we've always had these events, but what happens is when that land is in negotiations or our presidents are applying pressure in Israel, the size of these events become enormous and record-setting. Matter of fact, we have had over 80 record-setting events since the peace process started in 1991.
That's unbelievable. And you know what, I think, Bill, I concur with you on these things. And, of course, listeners, if you really want to get a handle on the scriptural support for what Bill's saying, you want to read Genesis 12 because it talks about the God's foreign policy to the Gentiles, that he would bless those who blessed Abraham, and that extrapolates down through his descendants, Isaac and Jacob, onto to the Jews. And he would have to curse those, of course, that opposed Israel. And that's what Bill's identifying. And the thing, Bill, that I think is fascinating, and I do agree with the relative nature of it. If, you know, for instance, in Gush Katif and the Gaza, when Israel was forcing the settlers out of there in the Gaza, we got hit with Hurricane Katrina. Now, that was very proportionate to what we were creating, helping to force and create in Israel. And here we go, bam, Hurricane Katrina happens on the shadow of that. And then, but when you say almost 24 hours, what that tells me, Bill, and I'd like your thoughts on this, is that we are deep into the last times, and that type of you do this, God responds this way overnight tells us that God's serious about Genesis 12:3 and that we are deep into the last days. Is that how you're sensing that?
No doubt about it. Matter of fact, for the first 6 months of this year, we've had $7 billion plus insurance events in the United States, and six of those seven have a connection, as I would say, to Israel. And what I mean by connection is pressure and then a corresponding event. And I totally agree, Bill. And the frequency is increasing because the level and where we are in this peace process is becoming much more serious, even to the extent that Barack Obama said in late May, May 19th and then 2021st, and since then, that Israel must go back to the six-day borders with agreed land swaps. In other words, that means give up all of Judea and Samaria, or most of Judea and Samaria, except for some large settlement blocks, and then divide the city of Jerusalem, which the entire world leadership is expecting Israel to divide Jerusalem. And we can look to Zechariah 12:3. It talks about Jerusalem would become the burdensome stone. And Zechariah 12:9 talks about eventually that God will bring the nations of the world and the armies of the world against Jerusalem and destroy them. And that's Zechariah 12:14 is incredibly important. And I think that's where we are right now in this timeline.
You know, and it's interesting when you say Genesis 12:3, excuse me, Zechariah 12:3. That's a very interesting prophecy there. That anybody that's attempting to divide Jerusalem up and the land of Israel, of course, as a byproduct of that, this it becomes a very heavy stone. It says, and all who would heave it away shall surely be cut in pieces. In other words, they're trying to lift up Jerusalem, pull it up, root it, do it, heave it away, and in mid-flight it falls right back down on them. There's just no way. It is a weight that God will not allow to be moved, you know, from a spiritual perspective. And this is what we're seeing. Now, I did want to say, you know, when Netanyahu came over here, he drew his line in the sand, and he pretty much went all in, from a poker expression, and basically he put all his cards on the table. He said Jerusalem will be the undivided capital of the Jewish state. Millions of Palestinian refugees won't be returning inside Israel. These are all hot buttons. The Palestinians must recognize Israel's right to exist as a sovereign Jewish state. The Hamas-Fatah unity agreement must be abolished. Palestinian unilateral attempts at statehood through the United Nations must cease. And he went on, you know, because Israel wants rights to defensible borders. The Israeli demographic population since 1967 must be accepted, and they won't secede the land. And, you know, when you talk about the big squeeze, I want to develop that thought, because Netanyahu really drew his line in the sand here. All of these are no deals for the Palestinians, every one of those. So I don't see how this is a deadlock that I don't see they can get past. So let's talk about that for a minute. What's this big squeeze that you're worried about here that's going on?
Well, that's a great point, Bill. What's interesting is Netanyahu is very, very sharp. He's been prime minister of Israel before. He also knows he has incredible support from Congress. I don't think we've ever had the level of support from the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate that we do today for the nation of Israel. Then he had made that powerful address to Congress. Not many world leaders have that opportunity, and did a fantastic job. What's interesting is he's going along because of pressure, but at the same time, his contingencies that you mentioned there are very reasonable. Those are reasonable contingencies, and he knows that he has Congress's back on those things, because Congress says over and over again Israel should not have to do anything that puts their peace and security at risk. So that was very, very well handled. The squeeze and the compression that I'm seeing right now is a greater interest in Europe and Russia from the United States and from the United Nations to push hard to get a deal worked out before the UN General Assembly is possibly voting on a designation of a Palestinian state in September. So that's a big squeeze. We also see liberal Jews and versus conservative Jews that are in debate over this land. The liberal Jews are saying, "Hey, give up whatever you have to. Let's just give it up. Let's make a deal." The international pressure, as I mentioned, Bill, they pretty much have the same attitude. You better do something, because if you don't do something, it's not going to get better for you, and the UN's going to vote on a Palestinian state, and then you're going to have to deal with that. And then we're also seeing that in political circles throughout Europe that have the same attitude. In country after country, they're saying we need to work something out now. And we're also hearing from a lot of people, too, that, you know, this big Arab Spring that's taking place in Egypt and throughout the Middle East is another sign it's important for Israel and the Palestinians to work out their differences. That's very significant. And then here in the United States, we've got liberal Jews versus conservative Jews going toe-to-toe in this. Conservative Jews say, no, don't give it up, because it's going to affect their security. And the liberal Jews say, hey, do what you have to just to get the deal done. And then also you've got a battle taking place from a large percentage of our church, which is the replacement theology part of the church. It's about 65% of the American church that doesn't see any biblical significance to the nation of Israel today. They don't study Bible prophecy, and they have no understanding of the biblical significance of what's taking place throughout the Middle East, versus those of us that are from the small part of the church that believes the scriptures from Genesis to Revelation will play out as written.
Well, you've covered a lot of interesting areas, and I kind of want to dissect a couple of these if we can. You know, I'm looking at an article you've actually got posted. It's June 25th out of the Jerusalem Post. It was posted, and it said the Palestinian Authority presents quartet with four conditions for resumed talks. Now, I just laid out what Benjamin Netanyahu told Congress, and I agree with you. That was an amazing thing to watch, to see the Israeli king, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, standing before the House and Congress and laying out his, talking the way he did, so eloquently. I was trying to think of what other world leaders would be able to be in that position to do that. So to me, I was so proud of our country for that, to be able to allow him to get up there and say that. You wouldn't imagine Hugo Chavez having that same opportunity.
Oh, no.
Or Mahmoud Abbas. But the demands that they are seeking here for the quartet, for them to resume talks, and the quartet, of course, would be the United Nations, the European Union, Russia, and the United States. They are playing off that they want those 1967 borders given back to them, that land that was acquired in 1967 with mutually agreed land swaps. That's right on the top of their list of four. Now, that is what I'm concerned President Obama did when he said that, when he announced, like you said earlier, that that's part of his plan for peace, is to give back those borders with land swaps. That played right into the hands of the Palestinians. Is that how you see that?
Perfect example. Perfect example. And that was a great concern. When he mentioned that, I go, oh, gosh. It's just like when Bush said two states living side by side in peace and security. Boy, once he coined that, that became the mantra of the peace process. And I was concerned, that's exactly what happened, Bill, and you gave the perfect example. And it's not only them. It's the international community. And as a matter of fact, the G8 met a couple weeks ago, and they would have put that in writing, but the Prime Minister from Canada, Stephen Harper, who's a good friend of Israel, says, no, I won't agree to that six-day border statement of President Obama. So they never got there, but they're thinking that. Most of the international community is thinking the same thing you just mentioned.
You know, and this, if people really have been following this closely throughout the decades, you know, there was a phased plan, Palestinian phased plan at the time of Arafat in 1974. It was really three phases, and it dealt with terrorize the Jews into conceding land, submitting land, giving them land, and then once you have a better vantage point with that land, get your Arab partners to destroy Israel. And you know, that's really, by giving them land, and Benjamin Netanyahu is so concerned about the indefensibility of his country, by giving them that land, and rightfully so, not even talking about the spiritual aspects of what you alluded to in Zechariah 12, but just the secular aspects of that, it's impossible. But this is nothing new from the Saudi Peace Initiative, which I think came out in 2000. It's nothing new than the phase plan, give us land. That's not Israel's land. Give us land, and ultimately, where's that going to go? Well, the Bible tells us it's going to go where they are going to divide the nations up, divide Israel up, and they're going to try to destroy the Jews and cut the name of Israel off. That's actually in Psalm 83. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing these things happen, and the very thing you're talking about, giving them land, is warned in Zechariah 12. So we have to continue to point our listeners back to that chapter. God knew this was going to happen. When the Jews came back in the land, all the way from that point forward, and the nation of Israel was reestablished in 1948, until the Armageddon campaign and when Christ returns in the second coming, that is going to be the land that is always going to be under some sort of controversy and problems like this. It's the epicenter, as Joe Rosenberg put. So that's an important thing. The listeners need to be in Zechariah 12. I do want to talk about the Arab Spring, you know, Bill. I think it caught us all off guard the way we rolled into this year and all these Arab protests started happening. You didn't anticipate any of that, did you?
No, I really didn't, Bill. It shocked a lot of us. We knew there were some problems throughout the Middle East, but I tell you what really helped facilitate it was Facebook and Twitter. Isn't that interesting that those vehicles became the vehicles that the protesters used to overturn some of these governments, and that's amazing to itself, because in the past a great concern in the Middle East has been the word in the street rumors that have always been difficult to contend with and deal with, and they actually had a place they could go with and coordinate the protest. And you know, a lot of people were excited about it, and the fact this is the people's voice. But I even shared with a family member today that let's look beyond this. Because the Muslim Brotherhood in Iran will be the ones that benefit the greatest from this, because they're the thugs. And the people that really want to see new government and change will be overrun by these two organizations I just mentioned. So it looks good on the surface. I know a lot of people here in Washington are pretty excited about it, but it's not going to, in the long run, it's going to be a bad thing for Israel. It's going to be a bad thing for the United States.
Well, and I couldn't agree with you more. You and I are not like the liberal pundits. I didn't expect you would concur with them. Of course, that it is. It's this youth bulge has been given the opportunity to see outside of 7th century Islam through these social networks. They've been able to look beyond the state-censored media and to what it looks like to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So the liberal pundits jumped on board and said, oh boy, we're going to have democracy spring up all across the Middle East. Well, you know, first of all, democracies, the only one that works in the Middle East is Israel, and power shifts go through rigged elections, assassinations, revolutions, and all those types of ways in the Middle East. So the chances of it becoming a bunch of democracies in the first place is very nil. But like you said, the Muslim Brotherhood, and let's just start with Egypt, because that really is a big one here. They are already pushing for these elections, and I believe it's in September, and they're organizing several groups. I think the number is about 17 groups. I could be wrong on that. That they're putting together, that are sort of coming together with their train of thought so that they can win those elections and stack their people in all the right places politically. And a lot of the people who were involved in the more noble aspects of the protest, the younger people and things like that, they are asking for more time, aren't they, Bill? They're asking for more time in these elections because they're concerned about that very thing, that the Muslim Brotherhood is going to come in and take control of Egypt. Have you heard much more about that?
Yeah, that's a big concern. I think at this point, just the Muslim Brotherhood by themselves, they're changing their names to deflect some of the focus. I think they, at this time, are going to run for 50% of Egypt's parliament. And they're also positioning a candidate for president. So you mentioned those factions, those 17 or so factions. They'll fall in line and probably work along with the Muslim Brotherhood to form a government. And the Muslim Brotherhood says if we gain control of Egypt, then we're going to implement Sharia law, the hardest, hardcore form of Islam. And that will also be a bad situation for the 8 to 10 million Coptic Christians that live in Egypt as well. So, yeah, I think you're right, Bill. Everything's trending in that direction, and we'll know a lot more in September.
Well, you know, and that's the concern. Egypt and Jordan have fragile peace treaties with Israel. They're definitely going to be called into question in light, especially if you have a Muslim Brotherhood predominant victory over there.
That's right.
They have, just look at their track record. They have been instrumental in bringing together the Hamas and the Fatah. They have, I believe it's a Rafah crossing, they've opened that, which, you know, now that's, why don't you just drive busloads of weapons into the Gaza? I mean, what are they doing to make Israel feel secure? What about that natural? They supply so much gas to Israel too, and they were restricting the flow for a long time on that. What's your thoughts just on Egypt's interactions with Israel? Because isn't this where this all goes anyways? Egypt, we need Egypt to be an ally to Israel, and it looks like that tide is turning as well.
Well, that's that was the situation with Israel. They were absolutely furious. The Obama administration pushed for this this change in Egypt, and they're also pushing for change in Syria. And, Israel says, we don't have perfect leaders in these countries, but our borders have been relatively quiet. When Mubarak was in place, we had a quiet border. When we had Syria in place, for the most part, it's been a quiet border. We've had a good relationship with King Abdullah and King Hussein, his father, for many, many years, since Six-Day War. So we've had quiet borders. And now they're looking at what you're talking about, Bill, a Muslim Brotherhood takeover of that country. It doesn't mean that they're going to oblige to the Camp David Accords of 67 and 68 and the Israeli-Egyptian agreement. And that's a big concern. They might just throw it out. They say they aren't right now. That's a politically correct statement. But that's a big concern. You know, what's going to happen to Israel? We're going to have a million Egyptians come to the border in Gaza and try to work their way into Israel. What's going to happen there? And plus, right now, they're calling for an overthrow of the Assad government. And none of these governments in the Middle East are ever perfect. They are so dysfunctional. But Israel's looking at it from their own national security perspective, and they like the quiet borders. But right now they're very, very concerned. It's what's happening on these borders, and only the Lord knows what's going to happen with Syria, with Assad, too.
Well, we want to be optimistic, and we know democracy is a good thing. And we hope things would work out well over there, even though it's against pretty much everything Bible prophecy suggests is about to happen.
Yeah.
But we don't want to be doomsayers on this whole thing. But let's just really look at the facts. I mean, Hamas, for instance, their charter, and they won the majority of the seats, I believe it was in January of 2006 in the Palestinian, first ever Palestinian elections, if I'm not mistaken.
And they won 74 of 132.
Yeah, and what did they run on? Well, one of the tickets they ran on and within their charter is the destruction of Israel.
That's exactly right, Bill. Another problem, too, was Fatah, Arafat, and Abbas's political party were ripping off the Palestinian people. A tremendous amount of money was coming to them and going out into Arafat's cronies' pockets. And unfortunately, you know, they were being maligned. And what happened is Hamas came in and said, look, Palestinian people, they aren't treating you right. They're doing these things. Hamas met the social needs of the Palestinian people much more effectively than Fatah, despite the incredible amount of aid that was coming through Arafat and Abbas to the Palestinians, because a lot of that was being diverted. So they moved into a position of power. It was also interesting because President Bush and Condoleezza Rice really wanted to push a democratic election with the Palestinians, and Ariel Sharon, the prime minister at that time, says it's going to be a big mistake. He said Hamas is going to win, and when Hamas wins, you're going to have nothing but trouble. And that's exactly what happened.
And I don't believe it was, you're right about Ariel Sharon, but there was also a lot of people around Bush politically as well saying, right, you know, you don't really know what you're talking about here. I mean, I guess I'm being too abrupt about that. But here, you know, remember, he came off the heels of that Purple Thumbs election in Iraq thinking, oh boy, we're going to spread democracy all over like, you know, fairy dust throughout the Middle East.
Yeah.
And he was being warned.
Yeah.
You don't know what, you know, if you get Hamas in control, you're going to be in serious concern. And of course, they've lobbed over 6,000 rockets into Israel up until that Operation Cast Lead. I'm not sure the exact number, but I know it was an enormous amount. But, you know, for the listeners, the reason we're bringing about the Hamas here is that they are a political arm into the Gaza from the Muslim Brotherhood. In 1987, that's when they sort of moved into the Gaza, and in 1988 they came up with their charter, becoming a political agency at that point, and that is the charter that calls for the destruction of Israel, and they don't recognize Israel's right to exist. The one thing Benjamin Netanyahu is harping upon, and he knows they're not going to comply, the Palestinians, is they need to recognize Israel as the Jewish state. How elementary is that, Bill?
How elementary and so brilliant and so reasonable, and I think that's a really, really good thing to continue to stand on. It's just that's the way it needs to be. And that, I mean, this is something that Netanyahu knows that they can't do, but everybody else would look at it and say, hey, that's reasonable. Acknowledge it. So it's really interesting strategy.
Well, and the reason they can't do that is, as you know, is that if it's a Jewish state, what about the millions of refugees that seek to come back and right of return into Israel? Well, why would Palestinians come into Israel proper if it's a Jewish state? It just can't happen. It won't happen. And so that's why one of the reasons why they won't recognize it. And but, you know, he said something that I thought was very important, Netanyahu. He said, you know, this isn't really about recognizing a Palestinian state. This is about them recognizing that we're a Jewish state. And it's symptomatic over there. Most of those members of the Arab League, if not the entire Arab League, they will not have normal business relationships, national business relationships with Israel, and most of them won't even recognize Israel's right to exist. And that is, I think, something the listeners really need to be sobered by. Israel's been existing since 1948, and they have fought to exist, and it looks like they're about to fight for their very survival, the way this is all deadlocked right now. And I think these last political efforts with the quartet, like you say, the squeeze, and they're trying to get Israel to negotiate and give up land, and the Palestinians are trying to go unilaterally to the United Nations in September. And I want to talk about that for a minute too, to have your thoughts on what you think about that. But you know, I think that ultimately this is the final Hail Marys, isn't it, Bill? I mean, this is it.
It sure seems like it. It sure seems like it, Bill. And I've been watching this daily. Actively with our news service since 1996, and I shared an interview this week that we are having a year's worth of news in some weeks, or 6 months of news in a couple of days. It's everything is accelerating, and I would also say this too, that the significant things that must be in play at the end of times, are in play right now. You used to be able to stay up with two or three at a time and keep abreast of them and kind of watch everything and oversee everything else. But, you know, there's 10 or 12 things that are in play right now, Bill, that are all biblically relevant, that are all moving at about the same pace. That's another key indicator for us.
Well, you're right. There's no weapon that hasn't been fashioned, no national relationship that's not being developed, like in the case of Iran and Russia. And, you know, and there, of course, they're in Ezekiel 38 and 39. No technology that's probably not in place. For instance, a mark of a beast where no one can buy or sell without maybe perhaps even a biometric technology. I mean, what's not in place for every end times Bible prophecy to happen soon and sequentially, Bill?
Absolutely. One world financial order, one world political order, one world religious order. And in the things you mentioned, Bill, I mean, there's, you know, 8, 9, 10 things. And, you know, it amazes me how this tiny little country called Israel, the size of New Jersey, is the focus of the world leaders. But that's the way God wanted it, where that tiny little country would be the center of worldwide focus. And we also know that Israel is going to be the center of God's redemptive plan, not only for Israel, but for the nations of the world. Because of Israel, many people are going to come to know that Jesus Christ is their Lord and Savior and Messiah. So that's the exciting news. And the good news about these times, as we see these things happening, is this is all about souls, and it's all about Jesus Christ's eventual return to Jerusalem to begin his thousand-year millennial reign.
It is, and you brought a focus. You said that the Lord wanted it to be where the focus was upon Israel, and
yes.
I'm going to draw the listeners' attention to a very key passage that confirms what you're saying, and it's in Ezekiel 39:7. I'm going to read it and then briefly talk about it with you. It says, "So I will make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel, and I will not let them profane my holy name anymore. Then the nation shall know that I am the Lord, the Holy One in Israel. Surely it is coming, and it shall be done, says the Lord God." And you know what we're talking about, Bill, there is the statement, the purpose of Ezekiel 38 and 39, this major, massive invasion spearheaded by Gog of Magog, Russia, Iran, Turkey, Ethiopia, a coalition of nine, predicted 2,500 years ago. Many people, yourself, mine, Joel Rosenberg and others are saying this is an event we need to be watching for on the radar. And they're going to come into this tiny Israel and try to take plunder and booty. God is going to stop it, not the Israeli Defense Forces, we're told in the description of this prophecy. And in the end, tiny little Israel, I will make my holy name in the midst of my people Israel. And that's the key, isn't it, Bill? That's what he's trying to say, is that he's a promise-keeping God who made promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he's going to show his worthiness in that he does keep his covenants. And that's critical for us to know, isn't it, Bill?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, gosh, it's so exciting for us, Bill, because, you know, scripture after scripture, and that one you used there in Ezekiel is just a perfect example. And the fact that Jerusalem will become a burdensome stone. You know, Zechariah 12:3 that we talked about. The fact in Joel 3:2 that God will bring the nations of the world that dispersed his people and parted his land will be judged. I mean, this is very serious. And then you can look at the prophecies of the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, and then look at the other prophecies of the New Testament, and especially Revelation. When you think of the final day events, God will judge the world for its sin, and God is going to judge the nations that come against Jerusalem and the nation of Israel. So, you know, we're at that point, Bill, and it just seems to be so close. We don't know the time, day or the hour, but we certainly know the signs because God gave us those road markers in the scriptures.
And speaking of Jerusalem, you know, and here we go. We're talking earlier. We talked about the 1967 borders. Well, in the Six-Day War in June of 1967, that's when Israel gained possession over Jerusalem, and ever since that time, it has been the hot topic. It's the breaking point of any kind of peace between the Palestinians and the Jews. Netanyahu is saying it's going to be our capital city of the Jews, and the Palestinians want it to be their capital city. And we're watching it unfold. Jerusalem, which sat basically idle for so many years, I mean, it wasn't even that important of a city. Yes, they made pilgrimages, and you had the Crusades and the fights and so on and so forth. But in modern history, we are seeing this stuff on the news, and the listeners need to remember that this is really boiling down to Jerusalem, the holy city, isn't it, Bill?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Bill. Very seldom we have a week go by that not a world leader says something about the city of Jerusalem and the fact that they expect it to be divided between the Israelis and the Palestinians, where West Jerusalem, central part of Jerusalem, and West Jerusalem will be the capital of the Jewish state of Israel, and that the East Jerusalem will be the capital of the state of Palestine. And it's remarkable. And how this is being addressed by our world's leaders. It's amazing. It's no other place in the world do they have this kind of obsession than they do with Israel. But this is straight from the scriptures, as we've been discussing. And it's all going to be, you know, as my pastor in Dallas used to always say, if you want to know where things are standing prophetically, watch what's happening with the city of Jerusalem.
Hmm. Well, you know, there's plenty of places in this world. There's over 195 countries. I believe there's 192 in the United Nations, if I'm not mistaken.
Is that right?
And you have bigger places than Israel. You've got Cuba. I mean, I'm not sure how that compares in size. I'm just grabbing that as an example. But could you imagine all the world threatening and doing about Cuba? I mean, no, it is. I mean, this has to drive the fact home to our listeners that the Bible predicted these things. The God of the Bible is the real God, and they really need to be paying attention. If their walk is straying right now, or if they're not even a believer but they're catching this program, they need to realize that the events they're seeing in this world are leading up toward the big battles in Psalm 83, Ezekiel 38 and 39, these things you've talked about, ultimately the one world order, we're going to have an Antichrist come on the scene. We're living in those days. We were pre-appointed, according to Acts 17:26, to the times in which we live, and we live in these very interesting times, and we are watching it come alive. And Bible prophecy is proving itself to be true, meaning the God of the Bible is true, and His Word is inerrant. And that is not the message being taught in a lot of churches, right, Bill?
That's right. We are so blessed to be that small part of the church that fully understands Genesis to Revelation is God's Word. It's in His inerrant word, and it's going to play out as written from the beginning to the end. And that's exciting. And we continue to pray and share with brothers and sisters in Christ that are in Protestant churches, replacement theology churches, that have never studied Bible prophecy. I mean, I literally figured out we have 100 million American churchgoers that have never studied Bible prophecy and believe it's allegorical and not literal, and don't have any understanding of the biblical significance of what's taking place right now in Jerusalem and in Israel and throughout the Middle East. That's amazing. It's hard for me to believe, but there's still a large percentage of the church that doesn't fully understand that. But thank God we do.
Well, let's drive that home for a minute, Bill. There's 31,173 passages in the Bible. There's 1,189 chapters in the Bible, and estimates are about a third of the Bible is devoted to Bible prophecy. That means about 10,000 passages and about 400 chapters are devoted to Bible prophecy, scattered throughout the Bible, not every chapter all the way through, but scattered throughout the Bible. And I don't have the exact number, but I'm going to suggest that out of those 400 chapters worth and out of those 10,000 passages worth, we've still got probably a couple thousand passages of and another 100 or so chapters of Bible prophecy that's probably going to find fulfillment in our generation or our children's or grandchildren's generation. So is that staggering or what?
That is staggering. And I'm glad you did it that way, Bill, because that really does show the importance of prophecy, Bible prophecy, and its accuracy. You know, we hear all these different things and all these different prophetic utterances, but unless it's a biblical utterance that you can point to the scripture, then you know it's not going to true. It's not going to happen. It's not going to be true. And the Bible's veracity and truthfulness is being proven on a weekly and monthly basis as we watch what's taking place in Israel and the Middle East.
And this stuff is, you know, you mentioned other prophetic types of utterances, and you know we. That cause brings to mind that Ahmadinejad of Iran, he's got his own eschatology. The Shiite eschatology that he's got, he believes he's been called to this very time to hasten the return of his Mahdi by creating an apocalyptic condition in the Middle East. And he's the one threatening to wipe Israel off the map. And you talked about Bashar Assad in Syria, who's very threatened right now by all the unrest in Syria. And what's going on? Well, you've got several things going on that I'd like to talk for a moment about, because you know, we could wake up one morning, our listeners could wake up one morning and see Scud missiles flying into Israel, chemical weapons flying into Israel, Israel planting a strike against Iran nuclear sites. Any of these things can happen. Damascus could go up in ruins, according to Isaiah 17. These things are not far-fetched fairy tales. These are the types of things that we're watching. Now, Bashar Assad is becoming much, much more dependent on Ahmadinejad and his Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Because they are helping Assad stay in power. Is that correct?
And that's exactly right. And what's also interesting is Hezbollah is really concerned, too, about the overthrow of Assad's government, because they've had such a cozy relationship there between Syria and Iran and Hezbollah. And they think that there might be a different type of leadership in Syria if Assad's overthrown. So it's very interesting to say. See, a matter of fact, there was even an article in Ynet, one of the Israeli newspapers this week, that Nasrallah of Hezbollah might even start a war on its own to get some focus off of what's going on in Syria, and possibly even getting Syria to join them against Israel. So it's going to be very interesting to watch the next few months what's taking place there on Israel's northern border with both Lebanon and Syria.
Right, and it's not a real simple situation, as you know, Bill.
It never is in the Middle East.
Well, you've got established war pacts between, and I believe this is around December of 2009, with Hezbollah, Hamas, especially Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran. Those are supposedly still in place, meaning if anyone gets attacked, they've all got to come to each other's rescues. You've got missiles and things that are in the northern border area. A lot of Israelis think they're in, the Israeli Defense Forces think they're in the area of Homs, close by Damascus and stuff, that their Hezbollah is being stored there, that now Hezbollah, there's concern Hezbollah is going to start moving those around with all this unrest going on in Syria. I mean, it's just a powder keg about ready to explode. And Hassan Nasrallah is the poster child of the Arabs, if you think about it. What he accomplished in the 34-day war in the summer of 2006 was really unprecedented compared to all the Arab wars, that the conventional Arab-Israeli wars and stuff. Hassan Nasrallah actually claimed, although we wouldn't necessarily agree with this, he actually claimed victory over Israel in that campaign. So, and you know, Bill, you were talking about, you told me before that Syria has the most advanced Scud missiles in the world. Is that correct?
Yeah, they have the most advanced Scuds, the ABs. C's, actually the B, C's, and D's that they got from North Korea. But the thing that I've really focused on, according to Jane's Defense Weekly, Syria has the most advanced chemical weapons in the world, and that's a concern, because especially the D's, the Scud D's they got from North Korea, as far as we know, they can hit any part of Israel. And then you put advanced chemical weapons in those Scuds, that could be catastrophic to Israel.
Well, and Israel has just completed the Turning Point 5 civilian defense drill. Turning Point 5 meaning they've had four prior. They're very concerned about this. They are training their society to know where the nearest bomb shelters are and how to put their gas masks on. And why? Because Scuds, chemical weapons. They're concerned about a multi-front war with Hezbollah, Hamas. I mean, the very things we're talking about are the very things Israel is fearing at this point in time. And so we could see this type of thing happen. Now, the Iron Dome defense system, they have, I believe, two of them deployed. That's a short-range missile defense system, very effective. And they deployed those to protect in the, I guess, in the Beersheba areas and whatnot. I'm not exactly sure, but they...
Yeah.
They are trying to get more of those, because Tel Aviv, what about Tel Aviv? I mean, that's certainly within Syria's reach. Chemical weapons in Tel Aviv. What a scenario, Bill.
Unreal.
Is that a reality? I mean, is that a possibility?
Yes, it is. I was in a briefing this week. Uzi Rubin, who was the father of the Arrow missile defense system in Israel, comes to Washington about once a year and briefs, and it was very interesting because he talked about what Israel's doing right now. They've got a three-layer defense system. The number one is the Iron Dome, which handles the short-range rockets, the Kashutas, the ones that have anywhere from 35 to 75 kilometer range. Then they're developing the David Sling, which will be able to take care of some of the long mid-range missiles. They're getting very close to deploying that. And the third level would be the Aero Defense System that the United States and Israel are cooperating very closely on, that will be able to handle some of the ICBMs, the missiles that would be fired from a long distance away. As a matter of fact, last year he said the United States had given and shared and worked with Israel. It's actually something the United States developed that can discover within seconds something the size of a baseball being fired from 2,000 miles away. That's just remarkable. Sure. And it can pick it up, I think he said, somewhere into one-third of the trajectory, or one-third of the flight, and take it out. So the United States and Israel probably have never had greater military cooperation. This is not only a benefit, obviously, to Israel, but it's also a benefit to us and some of the other challenges that we're facing throughout the Middle East. So it's a very good relationship, and Israel's just layering it up to be able to withstand everything that could be coming in. And Israel knows. I mean, it was amazing in this briefing. He told us what every country in the Middle East has in terms of rockets and missiles and what they were attempting to prepare. Their intelligence is remarkable. But Israel knows that they can't afford one or two big hits, because that's it. They're so small.
And, you know, it's interesting. One of the hot buttons with Israel is this is regarding Iran's nuclear program, and I'm going to dovetail in talking about what you just talked about with these Iron Dome, David Sling, and Aero Defense System, is that Benjamin Netanyahu has two hot buttons. We were all told this at the Prophecy Conference, Pre-Trib Rapture Conference, this last December 2010 by Jimmy DeYoung. Two hot buttons. One, if Iran gets a weapon of mass destruction, that's a red flag, and Israel will have to probably preempt a strike and deal with it. And two is if they get the S-300 missile defense system from Russia, which means Israel would have a very prohibitive attempt to try to do a preemptive strike against Iran, so that becomes another red flag. So Israel, of course, is watching those things very closely, but conversely, why wouldn't that be the same thing with the Arabs and with Hezbollah? If Israel is going to start getting more Iron Dome defense systems in place and their David Sling fully operable and all the Aero systems, that leaves only the enemies of Israel a short time to attack as well until those things come into place, because they would then prohibit the enemies of Israel. Is that not a logical conclusion?
Yeah. It's a very complicated puzzle. But at the same time, you know, Israel's, you know, they're on top of this as best they can be. But they still have a serious concern about the nuclear capability of Iran and being able to stop that. Israel does have four or five nuclear subs that are capable of hitting Damascus, Syria, and Tehran, and even Baghdad if they need be. But then again, you know, what's so amazing is these Arab countries, the Shia versus Sunni relations are very difficult and very touchy. I mean, you look at Yemen, you can look at the situation inside of Syria with the Sunnis and the Alawites, and you know, these are stories in itself. Look at the situation in Afghanistan, where we're trying to get out of there, and Iraq, once we get out, Iran is in the process of moving in, and then the situation with Pakistan. You know, we got problems throughout the Middle East, Bill.
Well, and you're right, and you have those schisms between the Muslims, the Sunnis and the Shiites, but the common thread that unites all of Islam is the hatred of Israel.
Absolutely.
And you know, so no matter what all the diversions and distractions are, and you got Bahrain's tug of war with Iran and Saudi Arabia, and you got all these crazy things going on, but all attention, if let's say Nasrallah takes his threat serious and preempts a war with Israel, provokes Israel into a war, all of a sudden all of attention gets focused on the Arabs' hatred and the Islamic hatred of Israel.
Yeah, and that's a big factor. It really is, Bill. That's a great point. This is your area of expertise. You know these countries, these neighboring countries, better than anybody, and that's exactly right. And that's been Israel's biggest concern the last 12 to 18 months, that they'll get pulled into war because of the distraction, trying to get focus on Israel, when all Arabs and even the Persians of Iran can come together when it has to do with Israel. And that's a great point.
And the reason we're concerned about that, listeners, is because the Bible prophecies are very specific. That, you know, Psalm 83, I see that as being a prophecy in a final Arab-Israeli conflict. You've got another predominantly Muslim invasion of Israel, described in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And, you know, so these things, we're seeing these things stage set. We believe these things. We take these things literally. And we hope that there could be peace achieved and things like that. But we are racing against the prophetic clock. And those things could happen at any given time. And when those things happen, it's a game changer for the world. And let's spin off into that for a second, Bill. We know, you mentioned earlier, there's going to be a one world order. And it's quite clear that America is heading more and more in that direction, especially with our current president who tends to be socialistic. He's pro-homosexual. We've got all that, those concerns going up now. New York just recently allowed gay marriages. Eric Holder, attorney general, earlier this year said the Obama administration isn't going to defend the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which defines marriage as one man, a single man married to a single, you know, one man to a one woman. All of these things are very scary. We're being pushed into this. We know one world order is coming. But is there a chance, like with the Tea Party and the type of Republican candidates you're seeing and the wind that's going about, like Benjamin Netanyahu speaks at the Congress. I mean, there's still indicators that maybe there's a chance for America that we won't be thrown into this whole socialistic one world thing immediately. We may be reluctant, maybe. We may ultimately drawn in. What are your thoughts on that and America's role these days with what's going on and what you're seeing in the Beltway?
Well, a couple things. The major victory for the Republicans in the 2010 election was extraordinary, because this was not a moderate Republican takeover of the U.S. House. It was a conservative takeover of the U.S. House. In 94, when Gingrich and all those had that incredible victory, it was moderate. But these are conservatives, and there are a lot of Tea Party folks that are extremely conservative, and that's what happened. And they're hoping again in 2012 that they're going to get the Senate and possibly even the White House. And a lot of the Democratic senators, I think it's 21 or 22 Democratic senators up for re-election. I think it's about 9 or 10 Republicans are up for election, and a lot of Democrats are retiring. So I think there's a good chance that the conservative Republicans will get a control of the Senate as well and have another significant victory in the House. And then the White House is looking good for any Republican candidate right now. Those are good, Bill. I think those are all excellent. And, you know, I'm right here in the thick of this. That's extremely positive. But what I'm seeing is a tsunami of these immoral agendas, whether it's abortion, the gay agenda, LGBT agenda that's being put through so quick, financial decisions that are being made by our country that's leading us quickly into the thought of a one-world currency, one-world financial order. We're watching the religious organizations of the world, World Council of Churches, National Council of Churches, and even the Vatican's Council of Middle Eastern Bishops that have called on Israel to give up this land. I mean, they're focused on that, leaving what they call occupied land, which we prefer calling covenant land. And I see that, and then I see all these weather-related disasters all over the world of incredible magnitude. We have major solar flares that we're expecting in 2012, 2013. Matter of fact, some of our top scientists are saying May of 2013, they expect a solar storm that could be anywhere from a $1 to $2 trillion event, and they compared that to the $200 billion Katrina event. And then you look at a lot of other things that are coming in place between 12 and 17, 18. They're prophetically significant. So there's reason for us to be optimistic. There's thank God that we're making some change here in Washington in a positive way as conservative Christians are concerned. But at the same time, we've had these events that have been developing at an incredible pace, and it's like a tsunami. There's not much to stop them or slow them down, as well as the focus on the nation of Israel right now, as if it's the key to peace.
Well,
so
and that's
where we are, Bill.
You know, you're right. We hope there's a reprieve here for our country, a Nineveh moment in store. But everything you just mentioned is a game changer that could thwart any type of hope we're talking about. But we hold on for hope for our country.